Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend, Duke University History Professor William Chafe. I have a hard time saying.
I do too.
Can I call you Bill?
Please, by all means. But no, everyone else does, yes.
Official. An incredibly interesting book for many, many reasons. It's called Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. Bill Chafe, thanks so much for allowing me to ask my questions
and
hear more about this incredible story. Why write about Bill and Hillary now?
Well, one of the things about my work, as I say in my preface, I grew up writing about the women's movement and civil rights movement, the sit-in movement. One of the things that always challenged me was the role of individuals in making history, because even though these movements come from the bottom up, they're still individuals who make them happen, whether it be the sit-in students at Greensboro and Woolworths or anywhere else. And I was also very interested about the relationship between liberalism and radicalism. And so I did a biography of Allard Lowenstein, a UNC graduate.
Yeah, I was real interested in your preface. You talk about how that led you to this.
Yes.
And it's many years ago, but still in Chapel Hill, there are disciples of Al Lowenstein.
Absolutely. And one of the most important liberal activists in our history, who both helped to organize the white wing of the civil rights movement in Mississippi, but also was single-handedly responsible for the Dump Johnson movement in 68 and the candidacy of people like McCarthy. But one of the things I discovered when I started to write about Lowenstein was also the way in which his life was shaped by his personal dilemmas, by crises that he was running away from with his family, his Jewishness, his relationship to his father and mother, and above all, by the fact that he didn't know how to deal with the fact that he liked boys rather than girls.
You were so delicate in your preface that you didn't say homosexual. You just said he was attracted to
young girls. Well, at 16 years old, he wrote in his diary, "I don't know how to handle the fact that I like boys." And, you know, the rest of his life was really part of always rallying young men to his cause.
This never – well, so we don't want this to be a
– no.
We'll come back and talk about Al Lowenstein another time, but just to get this straight, because you're delicate in handling this in the – you do not say he's homosexual, but you imply that he is.
Well, he in the end of his life, he was ready to come out. But he was married. He had three children and had frequently dated women. But anyway, the important point was that I realized how many activities of an individual are shaped by their own personal experiences, which goes back to the feminist movement. The personal is political. The political is personal. And so that led me to want to do further research on how the private and the public were related. And I did a book of essays 4 years ago called The Private Lives, Public Consequences, Politics and Personality in 20th Century America. And I started off with an essay on Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, which was, you know, pivotal to their whole relationship, was what went on in their personal lives.
I hope you're getting some of the royalties
lives.
From the movie, right?
I don't think so. But that book began with an essay on Franklin and Eleanor and ended with an essay on Bill and Hillary. And the more I started to write about Bill and Hillary, the more I realized that there's a story here that really had not been fully told, because most of the books that had been worked on were about either Bill or Hillary. But what was lacking was the sense that the chemistry between them in their personal relationship was decisive to shaping their entire public life as well as their private life. And so I decided this would be my next book, and I just had a wonderful time doing the research for it. I loved the process of learning about how their own really tension-filled relationship with each other actually had dramatic political consequences. I mean, Bill Clinton would never have become president had it not been for Hillary Clinton. She essentially brought to him a level of rigor, discipline, structure, and focus that he just didn't have. And she rescued him repeatedly. She rescued him when he was governor of Arkansas, when he lost re-election. She rescued him many times when he was running for the presidency. And interestingly enough, whenever she rescued him, she gained power, because there was a quid pro quo going on. She saved him. She gained new authority, and in the end was described by him, by Bill Clinton himself, as a co-president and two for the price of one. All of this after Hillary had saved him from destruction after the Jennifer Flowers scandal in 1992.
Well, the subtitle could have been Rescue and Dominance, in the sense that there are a series of stories that you tell about how Hillary, as you frame it, rescues Bill, mm-hmm. And then there's the price to pay for Bill. And could you, I mean, tell one of those stories. Tell us one of those stories.
Well, let's do Jennifer Flowers, because Jennifer Flowers had been part of this story for a long time. And
all right, now, again, we're getting into history, and although I know who Jennifer Flowers was, I mean, we've really passed. So tell us
sure.
about her.
Well, Jennifer Flowers becomes a national sensation when, in January of 1992, the election year, she goes public with the allegation that she's had a 12-year affair with Bill Clinton. Well, Bill Clinton was known as a womanizer. I'll go back a little bit and say that in 1988, when he was considering running for office for presidency, his former chief of staff, Betsy Wright, who was also a very close friend of Hillary's, basically went to him and said, you know, if you're going to do this, you need to be ready to deal with the charges of womanizing. Now, she herself knew about 25 or 30 women with whom Clinton had had affairs when he was governor, because she was chief of staff and she knew who he was traveling with and trying to reach him at night and stuff like that. And she said, you've got to be ready to deal with that. And he then gave her the names of other people that she didn't even know about. So this was someone who was a philanderer all the time. And Hillary knew when she married Bill that she was marrying someone who had this tendency, who was not necessarily going to be faithful, who had two different ideas of women, those who were one-night stands and those who you loved and married and wanted to grow old with. And Hillary was the latter. And Hillary was kind of ready to deal with that. That was a bargain she made at the beginning. Would this be worth it? And she believed that it would be in the end, because she felt that the two of them together could do more to transform the country politically. And she loved him. They loved each other. So there were five different women who were going to go public earlier on, and Hillary did not respond by chastising Bill. She responded by digging up dirt on these women to keep them quiet, to threaten them, basically, that if they went public with these allegations, she'd destroy them. And her team would destroy them. Well, therefore, they did not go public. But in 1992, they did. And Hillary's response was, of course, to stand by Bill and to rescue him in a way that she had done before. The interesting thing is that when they decided to run for president, when he decided to run for president, they had a meeting in the summer of 1991. With Godfrey Sperling of the Christian Science Monitor, who had regular breakfast meetings with reporters and invited candidates to come in and stuff like that. So Bill and Hillary went to one of these breakfasts, and they knew that womanizing would become an issue. And so even though the reporters did not bring it up, they brought it up.
And how did they they said, hey, Bill's been running around and
Bill said to the reporters, you've been very kind and gentle, and you have not raised this issue, but we know it's out there, and we would like to address it. And so they did, and they talked about the fact they'd had – it was almost literally the words that they used 9 months later on 60 Minutes after the Flowers scandal broke. They said, you know, yes, we've had problems in our marriage, like all people have had problems in the marriage, but we do love each other. We care about each other. We're going to grow old together, and we are a solid couple. And the reporters were bowled over. Hillary was incredibly persuasive. And so, ironically, this was kind of a dress rehearsal. And when the Flowers scandal did break 9 months
later,
they
were ready for it. In a way, they were ready for it.
And they already knew how to go public with it, and they already knew what they were going to say. So, you know, it is their idea. In the midst, you know, Bill is running second in the New Hampshire primary at this point in time. Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts is running first, but he's next door state, et cetera. And Bill's campaign is really doing well, and he's in the low 30s in the polls, et cetera. And maybe Tsongas is 5 points ahead of him. And the flower scandal breaks, and he plummets. He goes under 18%. And his campaign is basically in deep trouble, deep, deep trouble. And Hillary and Bill decide that the only way they can contain this is by going public big time. And so they actually arranged to be able to go on 60 Minutes the same day, the 60 Minutes that comes on after the Super Bowl. So it's got the biggest viewing audience you can conceivably imagine. And they just basically take it over and they say, you know, look, this is not a business arrangement. We love each other. We care about each other. And Hillary does the same number. Yes, we've had problems in our marriage, but I love this person. We stand together. We are going to grow old together. We are a solid couple who have a good marriage. And that basically just turned it around, and Bill's poll figures start going back up again. He ends up coming in second. But with
the comeback kid.
The comeback kid. He's the comeback kid. And it happens so many times, but Hillary saved it.
We got to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to tell us about the price that Bill Clinton had to pay, or did pay, or that Hillary extracted from him for this a wonderful performance.
Right.
We're visiting with Bill Chafe. We're talking about his book, Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, history professor Bill Chafe, and former dean and former and lots of other things, Bill. And our neighbor is the author of Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. We're talking about the New Hampshire comeback, one of the many times that you outline in your book when Hillary essentially rescues Bill. Mm-hmm. And then as you describe it, there's an adjustment in the relationships in which Hillary claims a leadership role as the person who rescues people.
Yes. Well, let's go. Actually, if we go back to the gubernatorial situation in Arkansas, when Bill loses, you know, he was elected the youngest governor in the country's history, 32 years old, in 1978, and he's voted out in 1980. Essentially because he's not focused, not organized, there's disarray in the staff, et cetera. And he's disconsolate. He doesn't know how to deal with it. He's totally depressed. And Hillary basically says, Bill, you know, we're gonna turn this around. We're going to basically get structured. We're going to get focused, disciplined. She brings in Betsy Wright, who she met in the McGovern campaign in Texas in 72, who was a really well-organized, brilliant person to be chief of staff. She brings in Dick Morris, which many of your listeners will know is now a Fox News commentator and a guru of the right, but was at that time someone who worked for both Democratic and Republican candidates, who I personally knew in New York politics and had seen how he worked. She brought in Dick Morris to basically cultivate a kind of strategy that would win the middle-of-the-road votes.
He's an evil genius kind of guy. And in the is that right? I mean,
I think that's probably a good characterization. He's someone who is incredibly smart, who knows how to find what appeals to people, and then goes at them in a way which is totally poll directed. What's going to work with them, et cetera.
I was trying to think when I read. I mean, everybody knows. I'm not insider politician. People know who Dick Morris is as the guy who can tell the politician what he or she needs to say in order to get support. And
yes.
So the argument against them always is, well, they're not being driven by what we need to do. They're being driven by what the public support.
Yeah.
But in North Carolina politics, we do have people who are experts at that. They don't seem to be necessarily evil geniuses, but we've got my good friends, Gary Pierce, who worked for Jim Hunt, would say, I did that kind of thing for Jim, helping Taylor, tailor that message. But I don't know who there is in North Carolina politics.
Well, Morris was incredibly effective at it. And so she organized these people, and she structured the campaign.
This is Hillary now.
Hillary basically ran the campaign for re-election in 82. And it was incredibly successful. He went back up by 57% of the vote. And the result was that Bill Clinton put her in charge of the most important reform he was going to attempt in his governorship, which was education reform. Arkansas was one of the lowest per capita states in the country per person in terms of educational expense, and it was had terrible records. And she took on the task force, directed the task force on education reform, went all over the state, had hearings, put proposed legislation. the legislators said, you know, you should be governor. You're really so good at this. And she became the most important single figure in his administration. Well, in some ways, that's the rehearsal. That's a rehearsal for what happens in 1992.
So just to put it in your framework, she organizes his campaign to take back the governorship in Arkansas after they'd lost after a dismal loss 2 years earlier. And then when he wins, she says, "You're not by yourself. We're a team. And here's my and I'm going to be assertive in that." And he can't deny her.
Well, he actually he totally welcomes her presence at that point. She becomes more territorial in the aftermath of the flowers thing, because at that point he recognizes how much he owes her.
All right, now back in flowers, we're now
back in the presidential campaign.
In the presidential campaign.
Yes.
We'll get back in. That's such an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So basically, in the aftermath of that, she is someone who he describes as his co-president, someone who's going to be two for the price of one, someone who's going to be like Eleanor Roosevelt in the White House. And she basically takes that on and essentially puts it into practice. How does she put it into practice? Well, she not only plays a critical role in the campaign strategy, but as soon as he's elected, she really takes over the process of helping to construct the administration. She does not want a strong chief of staff, because a strong chief of staff could easily erode her power by being the person closest to the president. And she's
you make a big point of this in the book. And can we prove that she kept going around saying we don't want to talk
no,
to you?
Or
you just
but she basically was responsible for getting rid of the people who were
the strong people
in the candidates, but could be candidates.
Well, who became chief of staff?
Mac McClarty, who was a kindergarten.
Earlier, did you say Christopher? But was Warren Christopher in there in that?
No, Warren Christopher was as a kind of he headed up the transition task force,
team,
yeah.
but he was a figure who was. Again, one of the nice guys, but not
very nice guy, but not a forward.
And so, Mac McClarty, who was everybody liked, but you argue that he was not strong.
He was not strong. He was someone who everyone liked. The interesting people in the White House called him Mac the Nice, not Mac the Knife. Mac the Nice.
But now, who would have been in that group? Who would have been a candidate to be the strong chief of staff? You got to have somebody
Eventually, of course, he found Leon Panetta, but that was 3 years later.
Yeah.
And he could have had James Carville. He could have had any number of people who were like Obama chose Rahm Emanuel, someone who was a really tough guy who was ready to make hard decisions. Mac was not ready to make hard decisions. He was not ready to tell people what to do.
And I don't want to even depress you on this, but Hillary knew that Mac could be dominated by her, or that he would not be the strong person.
Yeah, I don't want to make it as calculated as that. I think it's much more a question of intuition and instinct and reflex, and she doesn't want someone in that position of chief of staff who's going to really be in command.
Well, let me just say, this is another thing you taught me. All this is what you taught me, so that she had aspirations maybe to be chief of staff.
She actually asked whether she could be chief of staff, and she was more or less told that would not work because it would be self-defeating, in other words.
And again, here's what you instructed me, that the chief of staff has to be somebody who's willing to be vilified.
Yes.
To accept the bad guy role.
Yes.
And that for that reason, whoever was advising Hillary said, look, you can't be that person. You've got to be something. Anyway, all that, maybe too. I'm sorry to keep interrupting
but
complicated trying to put yourself ourselves in the shoes of any one of these people.
Yeah.
And Hillary, again, as you say, wants to be strong, and she does not therefore want somebody stronger, including what about the vice president?
Well, vice president obviously is by virtue of the Constitution and practical politics, second in command. But she wants to be equal to the vice president. And so, you know, from the beginning, after she's told that she's going to exercise a major role, and after she just basically takes that as the price of her commitment to save the presidency for Bill Clinton, she's very protective of her territory. And so she is the first first lady in history, to demand an office in the West Wing, so that her office will be next to Al Gore's office, next to Bill Clinton's office, and they all three have to sign off on everything. She really is it's her tripartite kind of regime. And when David Gergen comes in 6 months after the office, after the presidency starts, and looks at what's happening, he can't quite believe it. He can't quite believe that no one's in charge.
After it's my fault, but we've run. Would you hold David Gergen for just a second? Because that's one of the pivotal moments in your book. David Gergen comes in to help the Clintons.
Yes.
I'm talking to Bill Chafe about his new book, Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. He and I'll be right back. Back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Bill Chafe about his book, Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal. And we're talking in depth about segments of the book. And it just reminds us that before the end, we're going to talk about Monica.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we're going to talk about David Gergen.
Yes.
And how he, early on in the administration, David Gergen, who had experience advising Republican presidents.
Three presidents,
somehow or another, Bill Clinton. How did he persuade David Gergen to come in and help?
Well, I think Gergen has always been one of those moderate people who is seen as a bridge builder. And so I think Bill Clinton recognized 6 months into his administration.
He's a good North Carolinian, right?
Yes, he is. From Durham. And he recognized that he was in deep trouble. What had happened, of course, was that because of this territoriality, Hillary took over the health care task force, as she had the education task force in Arkansas. She really insisted on running it her own way. Many of Bill's own advisors questioned her tactics. Some of the leading women, Laura Tyson, his Council of Economic Advisors, questioned her approach. But she basically stifled them, and it became clear that she was in charge and no one else was going to interfere with her. Now, all during this period, things are getting polarized. There are crises everywhere. The administration is not working very well. Congress is being not very receptive. And Bill Clinton finally decides he has to try to reach out and find someone to help rebuild it. And sees Gergen, who'd written a very, very thoughtful piece about the failures of the administration in U.S. News and World Report, he basically goes out and recruits Gergen, who comes in and discovers that this is really a kind of a tripartite operation where no one's really in control, and he tries to assert some control. And there is a lot of stuff going on about Whitewater in newspapers and a lot of scandal stuff going on. And the Clintons, and especially Hillary, are being very reluctant to say anything about it. And so David Gergen, using all of his credentials, there was basically a war going on between the Clintons and the Washington establishment. The Washington establishment represented by the Washington Post, Sally Quinn, Ben Bradley, all those people. And so David Gergen uses his connections and goes to the Washington Post along with Bill Clinton's chief advisors and says, look, let's make a deal. If we give you all the Whitewater papers we have, you take a look at them. You give your own verdict. Is there any real problem here or not? And if there's not, you'll say so and we'll be clear. And so they agree to that. And Gergen takes it back to the White House. All of Clinton's political people say, it's worth it. Let's take that chance. Bill Clinton hears about it and says, I think we should do it. He said, but you got to clear it with Hillary. Gergen makes an appointment to see Hillary. The appointment is canceled. He then is told that Hillary is not going to turn over any papers. These are my papers, she says. I will sink them in the Potomac River if I want to. No one is going to see what's in those papers. And so a letter is written to the Washington Post which says, no, we're not going to do that. That immediately creates massive investigations by the New York Times and the Washington Post because it looks like there's something rotten there. And the number of news stories on Whitewater just accelerate. And that is what creates the circumstance in which Bill Clinton himself has to ask for an independent prosecutor on the whole Whitewater thing. Well, what that basically does is to create the day, in George Stephanopoulos' words, which was the worst day of the Clinton presidency. It was the one, if he could have one decision back, that would be the decision. Yeah. Because it basically, think about it for a second. That sets up the independent prosecutor. The independent prosecutor then becomes Ken Starr. Ken Starr goes after Hillary. He really wants to indict Hillary because he thinks that she's really more guilty than Bill is. And when he can't do that, he keeps on going after Bill. And that eventually leads us to Miss Monica Lewinsky, to Linda Tripp, to the wiretaps, and to everything which finally results in impeachment. So that one decision not to turn over the papers to the Washington Post is a direct start and trigger to what becomes the impeachment of the president of the United States.
Well, that becomes a large part of your last chapter, which is sort of the what if chapter.
Yeah.
What if and as I read that and thought, what if they'd given the papers to the Washington Post and it revealed what Hillary was trying to hide. I mean, mm-hmm. There's something in there that she did not want to show.
There probably was, but it wasn't illegal. It wasn't a crime.
I mean, for her, in her moral, I mean, her protectiveness of her reputation is her own
her sense
judgment.
Of self.
Yes,
yeah,
sense of self. Yeah.
Yeah, her ego.
And that that would have come out early on and maybe destroyed her authority in a way that would have put her in the position of having to cede some of the power mm-hmm. that she had.
It would have been a temporary blip. I think it would not have been a lasting blip.
You think Whitewater was just a blip?
Yeah.
If it had been
I think what the papers would have revealed was not anything wrong mm-hmm. with Whitewater. They would have revealed the fact that sometimes she overbilled. Sometimes she claimed too many hours.
She wouldn't be the first lawyer who's
no.
When I was practicing law, we accused some of our colleagues of using carbon paper as they filled out their timesheets.
But the bottom line is that she didn't want in any way to have her own image tarnished, even though there was nothing wrong illegally about anything that she did. So it really is one of these situations where. A sense of self-protection and territoriality ultimately ends up being something which undermines the administration and leads to the ultimate crisis of impeachment.
Well, we're going to take a break in a minute and then talk about Monica Lewinsky. Just have to do that. But your book, I always like to say, well, I already knew all of that. And there was a lot of what you told me that I knew, mm-hmm. just not framed in the same way. But one of the things that I didn't know or forgotten is that although we knew Bill Clinton had lots of girlfriends or one-night stands, and you assert that he was deeply in love with that there was one
there
woman,
was one
with,
woman
whom,
yes.
With whom he was actually in love. And then I kept on going trying to find out what happened to her, who was she? Where did she come from? Why did he fall?
She was a very attractive woman, very, very smart woman with an MBA, who had divorced her husband. He was an army person, and they basically did fall in love.
In Little Rock, this was
in '89. Yeah, and it lasted for probably 2.5 years, and he asked for a divorce. And Bill Clinton asked for a divorce, and Hillary said, no, we're going to stay together, and we're going to go into marital therapy, and we're going to find our way out of this.
Well, if I just missed all this, this is covered in his memoir, her memoir.
You
discovered, because I never heard of this.
It's out there in a number of places. Carl Bernstein talks about
it. Where did she go? Where?
She's been very quiet. There are pictures of her, but she's been someone who is essentially kept to herself and been a private person.
And still in Little Rock, you think?
In Arkansas, yes.
Well, that's it. Well, since it's new to me, just what was her charm?
I think she was very attractive. She was very bright. She was engaged.
Bill Clinton had he had lots of,
yes.
of good looking.
There was something about her that had some of the same qualities that he loved in Hillary. A sense of personality, a sense of style, a sense of intelligence.
You imply or maybe assert that Bill proposed that to Hillary that he needed that he loved both women and he wanted to keep both of them. I mean,
I don't think he ever proposed a tripartite relationship. I think what he was basically doing was confessing to the fact that he didn't know what to do because he was torn between two people he loved.
And so, how did that work out?
Essentially, he went into counseling. Both of them became much more religious. They found a way through the marital therapist of trying to work on their own problems, and they arrived at what appeared to be an agreement they would stay together and he would give up this relationship. It's not clear that he did.
And was this going on – this was immediately before the presidential campaign?
Basically, it was going on up until the summer of 91 and maybe a little bit after that.
Well. Well, let's take a break. And what are we going to talk about when we come back? We're going to talk. I'm talking with Bill Schaaf about his book, Bill and Hillary. And we're going to talk about Bill, Hillary, and Monica Lewinsky after this short break. Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Bill Schaaf. He is the author of Bill and Hillary, The Politics of the Personal, a distinguished professor at history at Duke University. And I've just been waiting because I want to hear the story one more time of Monica Lewinsky. And then there are things that you tell us in the book that I'd either forgotten or never knew. Mm-hmm. How did this happen? Bill, well, let me just put it in the context that you did in the book, and that is that Bill Clinton told everybody, lying, of course, that he retired from his—
quote-unquote retired.
Retired,
yes.
When he got to be 40.
Yes.
And he, I think, asserted that, look, in the White House, you can't get away with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I think Hillary believed that in the White House, you could not get away with that kind of stuff. And so combination of the surveillance of the president— that was part of their life, daily life, and her confidence in with their marital therapy when they avoided divorce gave her the sense that this would be okay. But Bill never ever lost his penchant for this kind of affair, and Monica Lewinsky not only cultivated it but played into it totally. And during the crisis of the period when the government was shut down after the Congress refused to pass a budget, et cetera, when everyone was in crisis mode, she managed always to be around the Oval Office as an intern and brought him pizza one night and showed her thong underwear. And later on that night, they had their first sexual encounter. She was just someone who provided a temptation that was so reminiscent of all the temptations he had succumbed to in the past. And once again, he succumbed, and he succumbed repeatedly over the next 18 months.
He succumbed. But you described this so well. And it leads into the I never had
sex with
this
that woman
because
yes.
He was, I mean, all the time he was having sex,
he wasn't.
He wasn't.
In right. His,
I mean, he in other words, he was denying himself the full participation in
yes.
sex.
Yes.
For some reason, he was saying, "I've got to be able to say I got to be able to look people in the eye and say You try to put yourself in the position. I mean, most people, when they get involved in those kind of situations, have a hard time drawing lines and saying.
Absolutely. I think that this highlights the incredible complexity and contradictory nature of the Clinton character. I mean, Bill Clinton is someone who aspires to make a huge difference in the world and to become really the savior of his country. And yet has a side of his personality which is totally and completely unwilling and unable to say no to sexual temptation. And he basically, that in some respects, goes back to his relationship to his mother, who was very flirtatious and very daring in the way she dressed and stuff like that. And so the kind of women he went toward for these one-night stands and Monica were women who were like that. They were very – they flaunted it, you know, and he basically bit. He just basically went for it. Now, you're right. He basically was also saying this thing, I'm not going to let this go any further. But, of course, the one time he did, it ended up in the stain on the blue dress, which became the DNA source of the pivotal evidence that, in fact, there was a relationship. Now, the really interesting part of all this is that Bill continued to lie to Hillary and to Chelsea when the story first came out. But this is also a very interesting part. When the story first breaks, Bill Clinton is he is torn. He doesn't know what to do. He thinks he's done. The first thing he does is call Dick Morris and say, take a poll. You know, will the American people tolerate infidelity in the president? And then when he's told that, no, they won't, he says, well, then we'll just have to lie and keep it, you know, and survive all this. But everyone will remember.
He didn't, and I watched this in your book, he didn't say we have to lie. He said we have to win.
We have to win. That's right. That's right. He doesn't say we have to lie,
but,
right?
But you say that's what he meant.
That's what he meant. And, you know, if you look at when he goes on the Jim Lehrer show on public television the night after the revelation is made, the allegation is made about the affair, that's when he uses the present tense. There is no sexual relationship. Not there never was, not there never has been. There is no sexual relationship. And he looked so weak and ineffectual. And he actually thought that he was going to probably have to resign. And then what happens? It's Hillary who goes on the Today Show the next day and says, this is all a vast right-wing conspiracy to get my husband and us together. And she essentially stiffens his backbone. He then goes into a much more powerful declarative denial. There never was a relationship, etc. And so he buys 6 months. He buys 6 months, and that 6 months essentially saves his presidency. What also saves his presidency is that Hillary, even after she is confronted with the fact that he really did have a relationship with Monica, decides that she will stand by him because it's not just his presidency that's at stake. It's their presidency that's at stake. And she makes the final decision that she will basically stand alongside of him and defend him and say, yes, what he did was wrong, but it is not a reason to impeach the president.
Yeah.
And that also – now, the ultimate fact here is that the same time she's making that decision, she is also deciding to run for the Senate of the United States in New York. So this is actually not only a moment of her final commitment to Bill, it's also a moment of her liberation to be herself. And that's what she does. You know, the day that the Senate votes on impeachment, she's spending her afternoon working the campaign.
Working with political advisor.
Working the campaign. And she then basically takes off and becomes, in many ways, a very different political personality. She goes back to who she was when she was at Wellesley, when she was at Yale Law School. A consensus reformer, someone who reaches out to people on the other side, someone who listens a lot, someone who is not the kind of polarizing figure that she became in the early years in the White House.
Yeah, it's a dramatic change, as you describe it, from those first years in trying to do the health care versus how she operated, where the Republicans were demons and enemies and a right-wing conspiracy. And then when she got to the Senate, she became, as you describe it, a consensus builder.
A consensus builder whose best friends were John McCain and Lindsey Graham.
These guys who were trying to kick her husband out of office.
Yeah.
Which is, gosh, it's an interesting story. Before we quit, this message that you deliver about how the 6 months of lying, essentially, about Monica Lewinsky was a time where the public got used to having an effective president who had lied and had also philandered.
Yes.
And that the drive at the end of the 6 months to get him out of office or to people began to appreciate his strengths more than these weaknesses, so that the 6 months of lying worked out well.
Well, it did, and it was compounded or aided by Ken Starr's obsession.
Let me just say, we can't talk about this, but it reminded me of the little parallel in North Carolina with John Edwards,
yes,
and his wife who were willing to come together. Don't want to say lie, but stand up and gain time, which they hoped mm-hmm. would pass.
Yes.
So it was a model that might not be a good model to follow.
No. And in the end, you just, the cover up is worse than the crime, and eventually it's going to come out. It's, you know, whether it's Lance Armstrong or John Edwards or Bill Clinton, it's going to ultimately come back and bite you.
So your rule is, like some political advisors, if when you've done something wrong,
fess up.
It's big now, but it will be bigger later.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly if you covered up.
Yeah, Richard Nixon. I am no crook.
All right. Well, I want to tell you, I've done some bad things in my life. I'm not confessing right now. Maybe later. But Bill Chase, thank you for this book and for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
There's so many things we missed. Can we get back and talk about it some more?
Sure, absolutely.
That sounds great.
Anytime.
Well, thanks to Professor William Chafe for his book, Bill and Hillary. Thanks for sharing some of that with us today. And thanks to you for listening. This has been Who's Talking? I'm D.G. Martin, and I'll be back before you know it.